From the studios of EWTN, this is Open Line with today's host, Colin Donovan. In North America, call toll-free 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 55000 or send an email to openline@ewtn.com.
A tremendous Friday to each and every one of you. Thanks so much for tuning in to EWTN's Open Line. If you'd like to be part of the program, the number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, we've got a number for you. It's 1-205-271-2985, and we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. And you can always send us an email. That email address is openline@ewtn.com. I'm Jack Williams. Pedro Quiles producing the program. Say a prayer for Pedro. We are having some technical difficulties, and Pedro is pulling his toque off to try to get these things squared away. So say a little prayer for him as we go along today.
Are we only broadcasting to Canada now?
Yeah, wait till you're introduced, please. Okay. Wait. Matt Kubensky is screening your phone calls, and Ace McKay handling our social media efforts. So if you're watching us on YouTube or Facebook Live, you can type a question into the chat window, and it may find its way to us by the end of the program. And our host, as he is every Friday, the anxious and antsy, Mr. Colin Donovan. How are you?
Well, pretty good, pretty good. I noticed your Canadian comment there. You know, Canada beat the U.S. in Four Nation hockey yesterday, but you're probably not even thinking of that.
Half of our team was sick, but that's all right. That's okay. Some days just being the most powerful nation in the world has to be enough.
I suppose.
Fabian writes in, what does the church teach about individuals of different faiths who know the Catholic faith but choose their different faith and their salvation?
Well, the church's understanding is based on the nature of man and the nature of morality. And that is, we are to know the truth, and the truth will make us free, as Scripture tells us. And somebody who knows that the Catholic Church is Christ's instrument for salvation, to which they should be baptized into Christ and should participate in the sacramental life and the liturgical life of the church, somebody who knows that and then rejects that in favor of something which may be comfortable or customary or whatever, they're choosing their comfort and their custom over comfort over the truth. So that's basically the bottom line, and that is a person who is seeking the truth, and we should always be doing that to the moment of our death, who arrives at the conclusion that what the Catholic Church says about herself is true, and that this is the means that Christ chose, has a moral obligation before God to follow through on that and to receive the full benefits that Christ intended for everybody who was baptized into him. And so that's the case. Up until then, there can be all kinds of reasons, obstacles. I think the scandals, which one would think that logically should not keep people out of the faith simply because we can't base our judgment of the truth based on the bad behavior of others. Nonetheless, these things are obstacles to a great many people, or raised in a particular culture and a particular religious tradition. It becomes difficult then to make that journey to over the Tiber, as it said. This has been especially true for the many pastors over the years that have been on the journey home, for example, who talk about having made this trip over the Tiber Bridge. So those are difficulties certainly compound the ordinary decision-making process. But if we're seeking the truth, we always must be prepared to follow it. And God has made us to seek the truth. And we should until the end of our life.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Plenty of time for your calls at 833-288-3986. I wish my wife was here. We would go the rest of the show answering this question. Where there was an episode of Women of Grace Live one day when an unsuspecting caller called in and asked a question very similar to this, but a little more, even more casually worded. And I think they got a little more than they bargained for in the answer. So Donna writes in, how do I answer Protestants who say God chose Mary because she was just a normal girl?
Then why did a normal guy save the world? No. You're the father. You can choose any woman who will ever live from the beginning to the end of time. You can dispose her and prepare her with the graces and the upbringing and in the culture that you wish your son to be incarnated into. And when all of that is been decided and determined and it actually happens and the angel appears to a young woman, that woman was Mary. And we have to imagine, if we believe that God's wisdom is guiding our life, and that we're following His wisdom, and His wisdom is always the answer to any question, then we should accept that Mary was the answer to the question which God proposed to Himself: who will be the mother of the second person of the Trinity made man? And the answer to his question was Mary of, I think she was born in Jerusalem, Mary of Jerusalem, daughter of Joachim and Anne.
Yeah. When the episode I was referencing on Women of Grace Live, I think that Johnette went on for about 25 minutes with different answers to the question, can you tell me anyone else who?
So that could make a good dinner conversation sometime.
In a related question somewhat, Ethan writes in, why is Luke 1:28 sometimes translated as highly favored one and sometimes translated as full of grace?
Because different people translate the Greek differently. It's a perfected form of the Greek, which basically means perfected in grace or perfected in charity, grace and charity being synonyms for the same reality. So Mary was perfected in grace. St. Jerome, who did the translating that we know we're familiar with from the Latin Vulgate, Gratia Plena, which is, if everybody's heard Gounod's or others' Ave Maria, Gratia Plena, full of grace, understood that. And so he translated it full of grace. I don't know why some translators say highly favored. Maybe they're looking for that glimmer of doubt that there might be somebody more highly favored. And she's highly favored, but there might be somebody more highly favored. I don't know what the reasoning would be, but full of grace is not just inadequate, but the perfect translation for the perfect tense of that particular verb. And Jerome made that judgment, and Jerome was right.
You know, I would tend to think, and tell me what you think of this, that rather than holding out hope that there's someone who's more graced, I think it's more likely that they're not wanting to identify any human as being more graced than any other human.
That could be, but you know, the tendency, especially in the 70s, which then John Paul II in Liturgium Authenticum tried to correct with regard to the liturgical text, was to sort of come up with these, you know, instead of saying consubstantial in the creed, which translate the Latin, you know, one in being, synonymous kinds of language that may be more understandable to the everyday person. But the trouble is, we shouldn't dumb everything down. The purpose of the tradition is to pass on the words so that the meaning of the words can be actually and adequately, faithfully explained. And full of grace does that in a way that highly favored doesn't, because as you noted, Jack, there's a glimmer of possibility there. But when you say full of grace, there's no more grace that could be added. Now, she does grow in grace in the same way that we all can throughout our life. But we have to assume that the bucket is enlarging with the growing in grace, in that from not from the moment of her existence when she was conceived immaculately to the moment when she began to cooperate with grace and be fully and completely open to it, to the end of her life when she was always open to it, that at every moment she was full of the grace that was possible for her in that moment.
833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. It's EWTN's Open Line Friday with our very own Vice President of Theology, Mr. Colin Donovan.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. If you have a question, call 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. Or send us an email to openline@ewtn.com.
Magnetism is a funny thing. I don't think any of us fully understand it, so
yeah.
We just do what works and move on.
Exactly.
The EWTN Pro-Life Pulse is your weekly recap of the top pro-life headlines moving our nation and world the mainstream media may have missed or ignored. Visit EWTNnews.com/pro-life and sign up today to stay connected. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Hats off to Pedro Quiles, working under less than ideal conditions, and if I didn't mention it, nobody would have noticed.
That's
833-288-3986. To the phones we go. First up today is Larry in the great state of Minnesota, listening on Real Presence Radio. Larry, you are on with Colin Donovan.
Yes, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
My question is, this is the Jubilee year declared mm-hmm. by Pope Francis, a cardinal in Rome who's in charge of indulgences has opened up a special indulgence for this year. And if a person, one of the requirements, there's probably six or seven, but one of the main requirements is to go to church, confession, and communion. Actually go to communion twice in one day. And if you do that, you get a second plenary indulgence only for the deceased, which are your relatives and friends mm-hmm. in purgatory.
Yes, uh-huh.
And then you will get that special indulgence just for those people down there. And my question is, on Saturday evening, we have a Saturday evening mass up here. And that counts as going to Sunday church. And then Sunday, they use the same gospel, the same first reading, same second reading. That would be a second time. Now, I asked one of the pastors about that, and he said, no, that won't qualify because one is Saturday, one is Sunday. But then, again, I mentioned that it's the same gospel and it's the same mm-hmm. Requirement for doing your Sunday, going to your Sunday services. And he said, well, he said, you got a point there. He said, you know, maybe it is, but I don't have any clarification for that. I'll have to try to find out through canon law. So could you tell me, would that count as to get this requirement, to get the extra indulgence?
Sure. Maybe a little history is in order for people. Typically, you can get only one plenary indulgence on a day, which means that all of the temporal punishment due to forgiven mortal sin, when mortal sin is forgiven, our breach with God that sin caused is repaired. But that doesn't mean we're suddenly at liberty. We can keep the money we stole or do other things. No, we have to. There's a certain cost to that. We have to give the money back, for example. So the temporal punishment that justice is owed is the indulgence delivers us from that as if it were an extension of the sacrament of penance. But you're only allowed to get that on one day. in something which I've never heard of in my lifetime, and I've been around for a decade or two since the early 50s, and is the possibility of gaining two plenary indulgences. So this is really a gift from Pope Francis, being able to do it. Now, an indulgence can be offered for yourself or for deceased. It can't be offered for another living person, but you can do it for the deceased or for your or yourself. But that one, only that one indulgence. So now you can have a second indulgence on the same day. So in terms of the other requirements of confession, communion, and detachment from sin, those apply to the to doing that particular work. The question of the liturgical day is not spoken of in the law, as far as I know, and therefore is a matter of indifference. The canon law already permits us to go to communion two times a day if the second communion is in the context of the Mass. So you go to morning Mass, and then in the evening you go to a funeral or a marriage or something like that. Two times in a day, you can receive communion at both those Masses. So the fact that it's a different liturgy is not an element of that. It's the fact that it's a Mass and communion, or really the communion, and that's what you're required to receive, confession and go to communion. The confession doesn't have to be on the day that you do the indulgenced work. In fact, at the time of the Great Jubilee 2000, John Paul II permitted that up to 20 days before or 20 days after receiving it. And when the Jubilee ended, I actually wrote to the major penitentiary at the time. It was Cardinal Stafford, who had been in Denver, and asked the question, now that the Jubilee is over, do those special provisions of 20 days before and after still maintain? And they wrote back to Father Colin Donovan, I guess. There was a P in front of my name.
That doesn't end a lot. That doesn't lend you a lot of confidence in the answer you're about to give.
But that was their mistake. I didn't put myself forward as that. I described who I was. And they answered it very nicely and kindly. And I still have the Roman document in my office. And in it, they said, yes, this is the law of the church now. So you have 20 days before or after to go to confession, and that confession can apply to all the indulgences during that total of 40 days before and after you do the work. So go to receive communion twice within the Mass, that's fine, or within a Mass and not in a Mass if the second one is on the same day. So you could go to the vigil Mass. You could go. Actually, this would be more applicable if you went to a morning Sunday Mass and then an afternoon Sunday Mass. But certainly the vigil Mass and the other Mass. But on Saturday, you could also do it twice as well. So it's really up to you on any particular day, because there's a funny thing in canon law is you can, to a certain extent, you can have as the time that you're using midnight to midnight, or you could use the liturgical day. I would say you can go twice on Saturday and twice on Sunday as long as you've been to communion each of those four times. And the confession within 40 days either way, 20 days either way, 40 days total, and that would satisfy it. And generally where the law does not prescribe that you must go to two explicitly different liturgies, that's not an obligation that's being imposed on you, because the law needs to say what it means. And so it doesn't say it, therefore it doesn't mean that.
God bless you, Larry. Thanks so much for the phone call today. That opens up a line for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Suzanne is up next, a first-time caller in St. Louis, Missouri, listening on Covenant Radio. Suzanne, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So my question is, my dad is in a relationship with, he's Catholic, he's in a relationship with a Islamic lady who was Catholic, got all of her sacraments up to confirmation, but now is practicing Islam, and she doesn't believe that they need to be married, but has convinced him that they should live together. So my question is he in a state of moral sin? because of this? And also, is she? And then, is he allowed to have communion then? Because he still does go to regular Sunday Mass and receives.
Okay. Well, objectively speaking, they are not, your mother is deceased, I take it?
No, he had an annulment with my mother.
Okay, so he is free to marry.
Yes.
As the other
and
woman?
She has been married and got divorced, but they were not Catholic. He was Jewish.
So anyway, it's a marriage, a natural marriage. So she's still married too by them. So basically you're saying one married person and one unmarried person. And that's all the objective information you need to determine whether it's contrary to the law of God. So objectively, the moral state of an individual, that's something they can settle in their own conscience. Objectively, it's sexual activity outside marriage, and therefore it's gravely wrong.
Does that help, Suzanne?
I
don't know if it helps, but to clarify would be a better way to ask you.
And
so
if
he's
you're
in a state of moral sin.
I don't know that, but it's presumably true and shouldn't be coming forward for Holy Communion.
Thanks, Suzanne. We'll keep you in our prayers. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. Brennan is in the great state of Michigan, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Brennan, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Hi, thank you. How's it going, guys?
Pretty good.
My question is, what's the difference between a spirit and a soul? And the context of this question is, I picked up a book called Beginning Theology at the Adoration Chapel, it referred to a soul as something that almost everything has. It's like a life pattern, and that the spirit is the breath of God and what goes to heaven. And if I may tailgate a related question, what's the teaching on ghosts of the Catholic Church? Like, you know, the spirits that kind of arrested development. They don't leave. They stay here and rattle chains and stomp around attics and things like that.
Sure. Okay. I don't know anything about that book, but I would have to contradict some of its underlying assumptions there. Spirit is a very clear meaning term. Something that is spiritual is immaterial. God is immaterial. The angels are immaterial. The human soul is immaterial. So the soul is the spirit of man. This is what was infused into Adam along with the divine life. So you can make a distinction, I guess, in those in the state of grace between those who have their body and their soul, meaning they're a human being and not an animal or an angel, although we are an animal. Genus and or family of animals, and those who have the Spirit of God. In other words, they have grace in their soul, as Adam and Eve did till they lost it. So when you're in the state of grace, you could distinguish between the soul and the spirit because you have the soul is what is constituent part of human nature, the spiritual nature God gives us at our conception, and you have the Spirit of God within you. But spirit can be used so generically that every single use of it has to be parsed to determine what the use of it is here. So when you see the trilogy of body, soul, and spirit, it's talking about the spirit of God and the soul of man and his body, in other words, man.
Yeah, Brennan, hang on right there. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment. We've got plenty of time for your calls as well. The number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. It's Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
If you're listening in the great state of Iowa, your EWTN radio affiliate needs your help. As they head into next week, Iowa Catholic Radio, with 9 stations now, unbelievable, across the great state of Iowa. They'll be airing their spring fundraising drive starting next Tuesday. So if you're listening in Iowa or anywhere for that matter, please make sure you support your local EWTN-affiliated radio station. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. We're talking to Brennan in the great state of Michigan, and he was asking about the difference between the spirit and the soul, which I think you've covered for the
almost
most part.
Completely, but
almost
not
completely,
all.
And then we'll talk about these chain-rattling specters that you see in the movies.
Okay. So soul, as I mentioned, the idea of a soul as everything having it is actually was a philosophical principle first found in Aristotle, and it meant that everything has a principle of what it is. It gives it its nature. But clearly, even Aristotle, as do Thomistic scholars down through the centuries who like Aquinas and others who follow him, and in the church this is the predominant philosophical approach, understand that to be whatever what gives the thing its nature, but not a spiritual soul, but a material soul. So when I said angels, God is spiritual, angels are spiritual, but they have no body. We have a body, but we are spiritual because we have a soul infused. We are given a soul at the moment of our conception. Animals have a body, but they have no spiritual soul. They have a principle which gives them life. And I think if we were looking for what is the material principle that distinguishes one material creature from another, we'd probably to go to something like the DNA that gives it a particular characteristic that distinguishes the cat from the dog, from the cow, from the horse, from the bacteria, from whatever. And so for all intents and purposes, the material principle in material natures, animals, is going to be that which determines their nature, which materially speaking is going to be the DNA, and which is also true for our body, contrary to the belief of many people today that your DNA is not determinative of what you are, but you can go to the doctor and have stuff cut off and other things added and make yourself into something new. No, we would say that the soul of material things is that which gives them their principle, and for all intents and purposes, you could argue that today it's DNA. And I've read that. It's not no conclusion that the church has made, but I think it's sort of satisfied the Aristotelian idea that material things even have a material principle to them. So what then to make of ghosts, for example? Well, three kinds of spirits, divine, angelic, and human. So is it the human spirit staying around, or is it some other spirit that's around? I think that those who are in the business of exorcisms, for example, would recognize that places where great evil was done, there is spiritual presences there. And these we would not attribute to human beings, but we would attribute them to the evil spirits. Ghosts per se, the chain rattlers, it's a nice comic device, and as sort of a, not as a parlor game, but at least one theologian writing in the 40s, Father Heribert Thurston, posited that the church should and ought to investigate things which have a paranormal attribution to see what is really taking at place there, being open to the possibility that something is. But I would think in many cases those things would devolve into the demonic spirit. Remember what Christ did with the Gadarene demoniacs. He sent them into the swine. The demons want to be associated with material things. This is their field of operation until the end of the world. And to be cast into the other place seems very premature to them, as we see in the story of the Gadarene demoniac. So hanging around is sort of what they do. So I would look for that more as an explanation than human beings who, want to disturb people. There are some cases where saints have reported, for example, or it's been reported that poor souls came to ask for prayers to be done. In other words, they're not in hell, but they're in purgatory, and they left something unfinished, and with God's permission, they requested it. There is one little book I read years ago that described how a religious came back and appeared to her superior to, you know, to have masses and prayers said for her. And so these kinds of things can happen with God's permission, but they're not there to frighten people. Good spirits would not be there to frighten you. The other side is there to frighten you, however.
Thanks, Brennan. We appreciate the phone call today. 833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. We head next to the Commonwealth of Kentucky. James is listening on the EWTN app. James, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Hey, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My question is around the language of those who know the church to be the church but refuse to join. Like, that's kind of a general idea to me. Like, if someone's, a Protestant, they think, yeah, I think the Catholic Church is right, but in my conscience, I feel like I can stay where I'm at because, like, I heard someone recently on the Catholic radio say that, jokingly, that the people that John commented to Jesus about, that they don't follow us, but they're casting out demons. And Jesus said, don't forbid them. Anybody that's doing that can't speak evil against me. And someone jokingly said, those are the first Protestants. So if someone says, hey, I'm like those guys, and, you know, I like the Catholics, I go to Mass, and I got Catholic friends, but I like my Protestant church. Mm-hmm. Is that a person that knows and is in trouble, or if their conscience is okay with it? Or just,
sure.
If you could kind of explain that a little bit more about that idea of those who know. What's an example of someone knows or refuses?
Well, in a way, you can only the individual can know that, because there's a difference between knowing. You know, Catholics have had, you know, a zealous Protestant say, you know, you're a Catholic, you're a Papist, you're going to hell. That's not telling me really any information that's useful. And so Catholics doing that in reverse to other people is not giving any useful information. There's an interior process by which things that we have been told becomes for us knowledge that we take to be true. And this is psychological. There's all kinds of elements to this, and the church recognizes it. And so it distinguishes between the forum of conscience and the external forum. And so people can be convinced that, you know, the church has all of these blessings, but they don't have an obligation. I'm speaking of that moment when a person concludes firmly the Catholic Church is true. Christ founded it. It has the truth. It has the sacraments. So there's a kind of knowledge of the truth which convicts us. And I think this is why I recommend all the time people listen to the Journey Home shows, because you hear all the stories of people who have had this internal intellectual and moral battle and then ended up concluding they had to follow what they knew to be true. So there's the element, too, in knowing and then having the will to embrace that knowledge. So the church understands, and certainly God understands better than we do, the difficulty of bringing those two things together where the knowing and the willing are together. And we let people have that space without judging them. But God will judge them, and God is the only one who can judge them, whether they have willfully made the judgment not to follow the Christ and the church. And this is where a doctrine which is often, again, thrown up into the faith of Catholics, how can you say that outside the church no salvation, for example? The church has a very precise meaning, and that is the person who knows that they ought to, but they do not. Who are they following? Are they following God and Christ? Are they following their own will? Everybody in heaven has followed God and Christ. Everybody in the other place has followed their own will. So it's a question of getting to the point of knowing this is what I ought to do, and then saying to God, I cannot do it because some earthly consideration keeps me from it. I think it's a different matter when the person says, you know, I need a little bit more movement. I want to bring my spouse in. I want to bring my family in. I'm going to take this slow. I mean, that's part of that process too. But a time will come when the decision has to be made, and I think the individual knows what it is. And it's always, as in every other sin, a choice between God, God's will, or my own will. And when we conclude it's God's will, we must do it. If we're just following our own will for all reasons of comfort and convenience and it's so much easier or whatever it is, it's still our will, and that is what we will answer for.
833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. Couple of open phone lines and still plenty of time for your calls. Kimberly's up next, a first-time caller in Bismarck, North Dakota, listening on Real Presence Radio. Kimberly, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Oh, pretty good. What's your question today, Kimberly?
My question has to do with, like, the full knowledge component of a mortal sin. I've heard it said that it's enough to know that something is a sin. And I've also heard it said that it's enough, or, like, you have to know that it's a grave sin, and therefore it's almost impossible to commit a mortal sin without knowing it. And I'm just wondering mm-hmm. which one's accurate.
In a way, both, because mortal sin is a grave sin that is done knowingly. So if you do something which you know to be gravely wrong, and I think most people have an understanding that all the things described in the Ten Commandments, there is serious matter or gravity in each of them, and that if we did eat each of them, you know, murder, steal, adultery, lying, giving false witness, lusting or avarice for your neighbor's wife or things, these are the central elements of mortal sin. And it can be defective because it's maybe in some slight way. Well, you know, I'd really like to have all his money in his house, or, you know, I'd really like to have that Porsche that he has because that's a nice car, and it's not really there. It's not to the point of avarice. You're not about to run over there and steal it when he's not looking. So there's degrees and between slight and grave matter in each of those things. The person who understands what grave matter is, that's the knowledge element. The freedom of willing, the freedom to and doing it freely, that's often the more difficult part, especially with the sins related to fleshly activity. You know, drinking, overeating, sexual behavior, and so on. These are the things which human beings, frankly, fall into relatively easily because our senses, our flesh is more strong than our spirits, and they're hard to resist. That's usually where the lack of gravity is. If a person knows something is gravely wrong, then they know it. It's in that degree, to that extent, it's black and white to them. You know, adultery is wrong. They might have questions of degree of that, you know, the degree of lust or whatever it is. But they know that the adultery itself would be wrong, and things moving us down that path would also be wrong in some measure. And so they may have some equivocation over that part of it. But the basic element, they know what's right and wrong, and most people would, unless they've had absolutely no moral education or any common sense. So it's usually the element of weakness or incomplete thought about doing it something sort of unintentionally in the moment without thinking, something where the will hasn't said, yeah, I want this, and you know, I'm going to take it. Like the previous question, really, it's the same thing because all sin has the same components. You know you come into the church, but I'm not going to do it. It's that I'm not going to do it, or it's that I'm going to do it, even though I know it's wrong. That's where the mortal sin is, the combining of those two things, the knowledge that it's gravely wrong to do it and the willingness to do it notwithstanding that knowledge. That's where the mortal sin is. Beyond that, there's all kinds of degrees of, you know, weakness of your will, force of habit, as the Catechism describes, all kinds of things can mitigate the gravity of it and turn something that is mortally sinful into something which is venially sinful by reason of either slighter matter than the full crime, as it were, or weakness of the will that, or force of habit that made us do something, you know, which we'd rather not be doing, but we did it anyway. And those kinds of things the church understands, God understands, because that's why they're, you know, they're in the church teaching. So that's the main components. There are circumstances which can make good things badly. You know, if a priest could celebrate the Mass, you know, and the Mass is a holy thing, but if he does it in some comical or trivial manner, there could be mortal sin attached to doing something that is good, otherwise good. It, because of the circumstances and the way it was done, that can change the character of the act as well. So those are the kinds of things which can lessen or even magnify the guilt of doing things.
Great question today, Kimberly. 833-288-EWTN's our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. Still time for your calls. You know, we have just hours and hours and hours of archived footage of Mother Angelica on her live show, and many of the greatest moments over the years of those live shows would be when she's interacting with callers that would call into the live mm-hmm. show. So we had the idea a couple years ago, why don't we start to take these phone calls that she answered and turn them into a little radio program, and that's what we did. We call it Mother Angelica Live Answering the Call, and you can hear it right here on EWTN Radio Sundays from 2 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And not only do you get to relive the great advice that Mother Angelica has given these people, and often hysterical analogies that are thrown in there, but also we've got some conversation about those moments with our very own President Doug Keck and the chaplain of EWTN, Father Joseph Mary Wolf. Great program. Check it out Sunday. Mother Angelica Answering the Call, 2 and 8 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on EWTN Radio. Next up is Katie in Indianapolis, Indiana, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Katie, thanks for holding. You're on with Colin Donovan.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my question. I've been a Catholic. Yes, thank you, sir. I've been a Catholic all my life, and I can't get an answer to this. And I've asked a priest about this. So when I go to confession and I'm absolved, and he gives me penance, I'm going to say penance, like three Hail Marys, two Our Fathers, whatever that is.
Mm-hmm.
But I've heard that that's not enough, that I need to do reparation. Is that correct?
Sure.
And if it is, what type of reparation do I need to do?
Yeah. Court, you know, it depends on, you haven't broken into Fort Knox recently, I take it. So you don't have to return the gold or do anything like that. But that would be a kind of reparation if you, you know, if you had to do it for something. But there can be the obligation, there are a couple of things going on here. We talked about indulgences earlier. I hope you heard that, or you can hear it on the podcast. There is this sort of nebulous formula the church uses that, you know, that the temporal punishment due to already forgiven mortal sins. So let's say you have stolen something. You stole, you know, something that belonged to your neighbor or whatever. Now, you can be sorry for that, and you go back and you have, you go to confession, and he tells you, yes, I absolve you from your sins. Your reparation, strictly speaking, would be returning that thing to the neighbor, returning the gold to Fort Knox, as it were. Beyond that, that has a great role in disturbing. Every time we sin, it's like a pebble in a pond. We're disturbing the, you know, the order of justice in the world. And one thing we can do is to do our part to do that, return the thing that is stolen. But beyond that, there's the justice of the sin itself in its own nature. There's the harm that it's done to ourselves because we did it. And so this is one of the reasons the church gives us indulgences, so that we can have an ongoing conversion, an ongoing reparation and effort. Because in an indulgence, it's not magic. It's that turning away from the sin and the fruits of sin to God. And the act is sort of a crystallization of that desire of the individual to do that, for which the church blesses it with the fruits of the indulgence that we are receiving. And so, but it's our ongoing sense of reparation. Or when we do a morning offering, as many people do, or you do use, say, for example, some of the Fatima prayers, which are all about reparation, you can use prayer as a way of making reparation as well. And that is, you are offering your day to repair sins against the Sacred Heart and the Immaculate Heart, or whatever the particular formula says. It's the idea that you're uniting your daily sorrows and woes in life, the good that you do and the suffering that you endure, and you're uniting those to the suffering of our Lord's heart and the suffering of Our Lady's heart, pierced with the sword, as Scripture describes it. And so uniting our suffering to that, that goes for reparation, not just for what you did, but for what reparation for what others have done as well. So all of those little things add up. And I think what makes the saints very often is they're not satisfied with settling their own debts. They want to settle the debts of others because they love God and they know that God has been wounded. That's obviously in a sort of analogous sense. Can't really wound God. But they know that the offense against God itself is a wound in our own human nature, a wound in the culture and society. And in many ways, the things we suffer in the world are the penalty of all of that. And so you can have an ongoing reparation by living a sacrificial kind of life to do that and to repair those things. And that's what the saints have done. We just had saints Francisco and Jacinta, and their lives, I think, are a model of this kind of an attitude of living what God asked of the three children and the rest of us in our modern world, a world which has seen two world wars, and who knows whether we'll see a third or not. But part of the reason we suffer so much in our societies is because of unrepaired for sin, and we can participate in Christ's own sacrificial act by reparation that goes simply beyond our own personal indebtedness. And I think, you know, so that's a further consideration than getting indulgences, physically returning things we've taken, restoring the good name of a person maybe we've gossiped against or whatever. Those are things we're more or less obliged to do in order to set the record straight. But even beyond that, there's a lot of record setting that's not getting set straight in our culture and in the world that we can participate in Christ's plan and Our Lady's plan to repair that. And those are the kinds of means of prayer and penance and sacrifice and daily offerings and consecrations to Our Lady, wearing the scapular, saying the rosary. All of those things are reparative, not just for us, but for the world.
Thanks so much. We appreciate the phone call, Kate. I just want to take a minute here at the end of the program. Yesterday on EWTN's Open Line Thursday with Father Gerald Murray, Father Murray was on the road. He was visiting his sister in Florida, and we had some challenges. It was nothing major, but we had to do things a little bit differently to bring mm-hmm. him on to be able to do the show. And I got so wrapped up in all of those logistics that I forgot to say happy birthday yesterday to my daughter, Katie, my youngest, who turned 27 years old yesterday. So I'm giving her birthday shout-out a day late. So happy day after your birthday, Katie Bug. Sorry I missed it yesterday. But anyway, hopefully we've made up for it here today. And really quickly, Colin, we got about a minute left. Charles in Southwest Missouri, he wants to know if he needs to declare his intentions whenever he prays the rosary, or should he trust that God knows his intentions?
I think you can do so briefly. You know, I offer this for my usual intentions or something like that. It's good, too, because it helps. Whether it's necessary or not is maybe not the point, but it helps us also to fix our mind and our purpose.
All right. Very good. On behalf of our host, Colin Donovan, our producer, Pedro Quiles, our call screener, Matt Gubensky, and our social media maven, Mr. Ace McKay. I'm Jack Williams. Thank you so much for tuning in to EWTN's Open Line Friday. Keep it right here on many of these EWTN-affiliated radio stations. You'll hear Beacon of Truth with Deacon Harold Burke Sivers. Today's show, he talks about creating life outside the womb. What does the church think about that? And they'll break open Psalm 31 on their Soulful Psalms section. Hope you have a terrific weekend. Last week in February, Ash Wednesday's right around the corner. Start making your preparations. We'll talk to you on Monday. God bless.